Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge, and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read whenever I get round to finishing reading it. That, like I said, there's no set schedule. Just whenever I finish a book, I stick the review up here on the podcast feed. So, I was going to do a little bit of feedback here, but I replied to the emails that I had, and then I've actually not got any emails in the last few days, or I haven't been able to check my emails, mainly because I'm on a ship that's so far north that it can't get connected to any communication satellites, which has been really fun, actually. For those who don't know, I work as a juggler, a professional juggler, and I perform about once a month on various cruise ships around the world. And at the moment, we're up in the Arctic, but way above the Arctic Circle. We're just at the moment, it's in the morning now, and we're approaching Spitsbergen to Longyearbyen in Spitsbergen. So that's quite interesting. And yesterday we went up to the Arctic pack ice, and I reached 81 degrees 21 minutes and 13 seconds north, and I don't think I'm ever going to reach further north than that in my life, unless I have, for some reason, to visit the North Pole. But, you know, I don't think there's any reason to ever visit the North Pole, except if you're actually, you know, really going there, because there's nothing between where we were yesterday and the North Pole at all. So, I mean, I guess that's probably as far north as I'm ever going to get. Yes, but like I say, no internet connection here. But apparently there's good internet connection in Longyearbyen in Spitsbergen, on Spitsbergen. So hopefully I'll upload this this podcast there. Otherwise it might be a bit later. Maybe, you know, next, you know, probably about, maybe it could be five or six days before I have a chance to upload this again. Anyway, I don't know. I'll be posting more travel news and stories and photos and videos and stuff like that on my blog in the coming weeks. And also small updates on Twitter. Give some of those addresses at the end of the podcast, I guess. So, anyway, on to the podcast review, the book review this time. I actually finished this book a few days ago. I read it on my iPod Touch, and it's quite a short novel, so it's a perfect length to read on the iPod there. Why did I read this book in particular? Well, there's a few reasons, really, because I was struggling through Last and First Men, which is, you know, quite an old book. It's written back in 1930, and the writing style is just so dry, and it's just a bit drab as well. You know, it's lots of, you know, explaining stuff, but like in this way, which is, well, I'll get onto it. I'm probably not going to finish that book, but I will review it, so I don't want to get too much into it. But I was looking and thinking, is this writing style like so alien because it's you know, because it's the writing of this book in particular, or is it just because it's so old? So I thought, well, okay, I'll check out some other early science fiction. The only other early science fiction that I've reviewed so far, or really early science fiction, is H.G. Wells. So I thought, well, I'll go back even further and I'll read some Jules Verne's, you know, some really, really old science fiction right back to the very beginning. And I've read actually most of his famous novels. I've read Around the World in 80 Days, and I've read 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, and I've read Journey to the Center of the Earth, but I've never actually read From the Earth to the Moon. And I thought, well, I'll read this one because it's very topical as well, because, you know, 40th anniversary of the Apollo moon landings too, and it was written in 1865, so it's one of his earliest science fiction works, and of course, because it's one of his earliest science fiction works, it's one of the earliest science fiction works, full stop. So yeah, let's do it. From the Earth to the Moon. Last episode, I got a bit confused about the name. I was like, it's called A Trip to the Moon, you know. But I actually looked it up the other day on Wikipedia, and it turns out that this book is actually always just called From the Earth to the Moon in English. But then there was a second book that he wrote called Around the Moon, and then when you actually see these books combined together, it's called A Trip to the Moon Around It. So I was guessing I was getting mixed up between the book A Trip to the Moon and Around It with From the Earth to the Moon. So, yeah, 1865, quite a short novel. Really, really good fun to read. Let me get straight into it then. The world of the book. The best way to read really old science fiction set in the future, in their time, but in the past and our time, is just to think of it as some kind of alternative reality world, which is a good way to do it. This is set after the American Civil War, sometime before the First World War, but here's the key. The First World War hasn't happened yet, as Jules Verne is writing it. And so when he writes it, he's like saying, okay, all these people doing this, they've got all this war equipment laying around, and the members of the gun club don't have anything to do. and this gun club, the Boston Gun Club, or the Massachusetts Gun Club, don't have anything to do. So the president, a man named Barbicane, proposes to use their expertise and to use their money and to use their connections and everything like that for a big, like, prestigious science project slash, you know, for the betterment of all mankind to reach the moon. Let's build a cannon so big that we can fire something at the moon. We can actually, you know, shoot something at the moon. And also we build a big telescope and follow it to the moon and see it land there, you know, and everyone's going, good idea. So that's actually what happens at the beginning of the book. There's this big meeting called, yeah, I'm just getting straight onto the story here. Big meeting called, he proposes this and everyone's like, woo, let's do it. So then the story follows this. Of course, they might make a cannon which shoots a ball at 12,000 yards per second. That's what he's calculated to, you know, that's what he's going to have to shoot at ground level. That's how fast it's going to have to go as it leaves the Earth to actually reach the moon. And it talks of all the technical issues, you know, like, you know, how will they be able to do it, and, you know, where will they build the cannon, and, you know, how will they design the cannon and the cannonball, and how will they aim it, and when will they fire it, and all these different questions. They sort of bring up these questions and then answer them in a very scientific way. And so, yeah, there's a lot of technical issues, as I said, and this takes up most of the rest of the book. It reminds me quite a lot of sort of a lot more modern science fiction books where, you know, you have these sort of budget space program kind of books, which I know Stephen Baxter writes, and there's quite a few other people, like Larry Niven has written a few of these and things like that, where you get this group of people who need to get into space, but they're not part of NASA or they're not part of any country, but they still want to get into space, and they're buying up lists. And it's that same kind of thing. It's sort of like, how could you get into space if, or this is what the author's saying, it's like, if I was the head of NASA or something, this is the kind of technology I would use to get into space. And it's really the first kind of book of that kind, you know, the first book of that kind. So, yeah, you read about them building it, and then, you know, up until this point, they're building the cannon, this is. And up until this point, you realize, ah, okay, this is just going to be a shot to the moon. But then someone, this Frenchman, sends a telegraph and says, telegram, and he says, I'm going to come over, and what you should do is make a capsule which is big enough and hollow enough for a person to sit inside it, and you can shoot me at the moon. And this is already a long way into the book, so I don't want to spoil it anymore, but that's when it becomes not just firing a cannon at the moon, but actually a trip to the moon, you know. So that's good fun. And, of course, there's the questions. It's like, will I make it to the moon? Or will he make it to the moon? And, you know, will he be able to survive the massive acceleration in the initial blast? You know, but you got to read it to find out. But it is actually quite a good, fun story. Not, like I said before, not a huge amount of story. But what is there? And, like, the small subplots are quite interesting in its own right. And, like, the tension that's like, okay, will they make it to the moon? You know, what's going to happen here? Will they be able to do this and do that? Is very well written. But, of course, this was actually first serialized in a newspaper. So, you know, it doesn't really feel too episodic, but it feels quite even, if you know what I mean. So you're reading it and you're going, okay, and then okay, and then okay, like that. And you, as you read it through, you there's no cliffhangers, which is very strange because, you know, fiction from 1865 is obviously a lot different from anything in the modern day. So yeah, the way the story is put together isn't, like I say, too modern, isn't the most exciting story, but what is there is actually really fun. The characters, you've got, of course, you've got Barbicane, who is the president of the gun club. He's this old curmudgeon, but and he sort of in the end wields ultimate power over everyone else in the whole project. Which is good fun. But then there's his rival when they're developing guns before the book starts. You know, there's Barbicane. He's always like the main guy developing shot and the cannons. And then there's the guy who's developing the armor. His name is Nicol, and he designs armor for ships and things like that. So there was always this big rivalry between the two of them. Barbicane would always make a larger shot, and Nicol would always be able to make some plate armor that would stop the shot. And it's really great. But then it gets to the point you actually read in the book, a really fun section where it tells of their battle between the two. They weren't so much a battle, but, you know, their main argument. And Nicol was going, hey, I've got this plate here, and it'll stop anything that you can ever fire at it. So come on, make a gun. And Barbican's like, nah, the war's over, I'm not really bothered. And Nicol's like, no, really, if you really, really think you can, you know, beat my my armored plate, you do it. And Barbican's like, not really interested in doing it. He says, tell you what, we'll put the plate up, And at 100 metres, you can fire anything you want at this plate, and I'll stand behind the plate, and you can do it. That's how you know, how we'll set it up. And Barbican sends a message back saying, even if you're standing in front of the plate, I'm not going to bother with this. So, you know, there's some real animosity between the two of these, and it's really fun to read. And this is it, they've got some really great character moments here when they have this duel. They get into an argument, and they have a duel. You know, they go into this forest and they've both got a gun each and they've got to find each other, and the first one to shoot the other one, you know, wins. And again, I don't really want to spoil it, but you get some amazing little insights into their characters here. And this is a good thing. You never really told much about the characters, but or you don't really see them interacting between each other very much, some of these main characters. But when you do get it, it's sort of like just in a few words, or just in a, like a small paragraph, you actually learn so much about their attitude and about what they're like as a person. Two of the characters, or the two of the main characters, one is, of course, Michel Ardenne, the French adventurer, who's good fun because he's naive. He's just like, I'm an adventurer. He doesn't care about science at all. Like, these other guys are all scientists and technicians and engineers and stuff, and he's just like, let me just get in there. I'll just go to the moon. No problem. I don't need to worry about anything. Yeah, I'll go to the moon. Yeah, I think there's air on the moon, isn't there? Yeah, I think there is an air on the moon, all that kind of stuff. And the other character is the secretary of the gun club, who's called J.T. Maston, and he's got this boundless enthusiasm, very one-dimensional character, but very good. He's sort of like, by the end of the book, quite a tragic character in the end as well. But again, I don't really want to give too much away there. Good fun, though. No other characters mentioned in the book. Oh, there's a few, but generally not a lot there to go on. Those are the four main characters there. Technology and science and stuff. Well, the science in the book is, of course, very dated. It is from 1865. You know, they talk about, hey, look at this. There's the Andromeda Nebula. And they go, and I'm not sure if it's the translation of the book, but of course they say, like a nebula is, the Milky Way is a nebula as well. So they're talking about galaxies. And then they say that there's only other, we work out there's about 5,000 galaxies. You know, reading that now and thinking there's only 5,000 galaxies is quite interesting. And the things like where he goes, and he lists the moons of the solar system. So Uranus has 8 moons, and Saturn has 8 moons, and Jupiter has 4 moons. And you're like going, right, if you say so. But then they say they build a telescope which is power enough to see the planet going around the star Sirius. And I'm thinking, well, if they can see the planet going around Sirius, surely they must have found the other moons of Jupiter. But of course, you know, they don't have the telescopes really at the time that it was written weren't that powerful. And of course, I made a note here, aluminium. They're going to build the shot out of aluminium to make it really light, which I guess is like quite prescient in the aero technology at the moment. Things are made out of aluminium because it's the best material to make spaceships out of and all these other things out of. So that's really fun. But of course, at the time, it's like the most like expensive metal to make. It's like they were going, oh no, it's extremely costly, we can't afford all that much aluminium. But they said, no, we're gonna do it. And that's a cool thing, actually, because while some of the science and technology is just way off, you know, just there's never gonna, you know, you read it and you go, well, okay, that's not gonna work, some of the stuff seems to hit like dead on. And you realize that, okay, maybe this is so dead on because it's influenced the Apollo missions or influenced other technology, or maybe it's because it's so, I wouldn't say rigorous science, but because it's so based on science, of course, it's going to follow what happens in real life space programs and aeroplanes and all these other methods of flight which were invented past this book. So, for example, you know, instead of having a countdown to launch, 10, 9, 8, they have a count up to the launch because they have to fire the shot at the exact time, and it's 40 seconds past a minute. So they're going like 37, 38, 39, 40, fire, you know, that kind of stuff. So in the same way that you do the countdowns for all of the people watching, you know, because it's not for the people in the rocket. They just press the button. It's not for the people in the control. You know, it's actually the countdown is for the audience watching to sort of build the tension and to make sure nobody's looking away at that exact time. And of course, being shot from, they get shot up from Florida because they have to be as near to the equator as possible and still be in the United States. And of course, that's what happened with the moonshot. And also they have a 3-person capsule And again, maybe that's just like having three people in the capsule. Maybe that's just the best sort of balance between enough people and not too much weight. Because when you read about it, like this shot, the cannon shot that they're firing, or like the artillery shell that the people sit in and get fired to the moon, is about the same size as an Apollo capsule as well. So I think that's just one of those sort of like coming together out of necessity and science. And also, of course, the cannon itself, which is good fun, is called the Columbiad. And of course, there's a space shuttle Columbia. But again, those are both named from a common root. It's not like the space shuttle Enterprise, which was blatantly named after Star Trek. But the Columbiad and the Columbia are both from the root of Columbus. Like, it's a discovery, you know, that's the idea there. Going on a journey of discovery. Some of the fun things about this book is that you're reading about technology that you don't really read about in any modern science fiction. For example, building a massive cannon and pouring the iron into the molds and laying gunpowder, which is really good. And then also how they do all of this kind of stuff with no electricity, or with, you know, the only tiny bits of electricity here and then, and having to do everything by, you know, telegraph and communicating in that way. And, you know, all of these different things, like using so much old technology to actually make this new technology, or to, you know, to read about space flight. It's like, you know, in a way you could read it as steampunk, but this isn't steampunk. This is actually science fiction, but from the steampunk era. And to be honest, it's actually better than most steampunk, because it's a lot more thorough in its science and in its technology, which is cool. It's not just like have a story but set it with airships and stuff instead of spaceships. Oh yeah, and also they build the biggest telescope known to man, or known on the whole Earth, you know. But they don't have reflective telescopes yet. It's still building massive lenses in the air, which is quite interesting. It's really good fun to read all this. For me, it's really good fun. And also, there's lots of other ideas which are sort of secondary to the actual plot and the story. For example, they're saying, okay, are there men in the moon? And if there are men in the moon, how would we communicate them with here on Earth? This is way before radio. So what, you know, this Russian guy decides to do is, like, he says, well, what we should do is draw huge letters, like scientific, not sort of scientific, but mathematical symbols across Russia, you know. And if we write these letters big enough, when they look to us through their telescope, they'll be able to read it. They'll be able to write something across the face of the moon. And it's that same kind of like communicating by big objects, which has been done. I've read I can't remember what it's called. Maybe it's called Red Dust or something like that. A book about going to Mars, and it's the face on Mars was a way of attracting humans' attentions to Mars. I mean, it's a bit of a stupid idea, but again, it has been explored in other science fiction books. And there's lots of good stuff there. I don't think I need to go anything more about that, but it's a lot of good fun ideas. A bit about the writing style. It does read sometimes a bit like a technical document, because it is really technical. Like I say, the characters, the character moments are there, but for big parts of it, because it's sort of written in this like third person, like omnipresent, distant narrator, like almost like a newspaper report about it, or, you know, someone's written up a report about this kind of thing to share like the real story about what's happening. And that's, again, it's interesting, and it's because, like I say, it seems to be influenced very much by the journalistic style, because this story was first, you know, serialized in newspapers, so it's not, so it's written in that kind of newspaper kind of style, journalistic kind of style. But it's not just a technical document, because it's actually full of humor. There's a lot of things to laugh at here. He makes the world, Verne makes the world very, like, rich in many ways, and full of character. The world is actually full of character itself. When he's talking about the gun club members, they're all experimenting with their explosives, and of course they're all losing limbs. And he says something like, there's like, in any group of 10, there's only 8 legs between them and 12 arms or something. Actually, I got my iPod here. I made a bookmark on this because I really liked about it. Oh yeah, it says here, someone calculated that there's not quite one arm between 4 persons and 2 legs between 6. So that's, I mean, it's a real way of setting up like how dangerous it is to work in the in the artillery business and experiment with explosives and things like that. So that's all. That's quite a lot of fun. And there's lots of these things, like once they propose it, you know, there's this person putting on a play and he puts on the Shakespeare play, Much Ado About Nothing, and people think it's a comment on this big sort of space race idea, and it doesn't go down very well. So then instead he puts on the play As You Like It, and then he sells out his theatre time and time again. So, you know, it's all these little, you know, these little comments about what's happening in the world, which make it a lot of fun. But sometimes it does lapse a little bit into lists. Like, for example, he writes the list of banks where people could go to donate money, like everyone around the world could donate money if they wanted to support this big scheme, this big, you know, shot at the moon. So you like, that's just like a whole page, like a whole massive paragraph of just a list of banks around the world. And again, it doesn't make sense much to me, but then, like, for people actually reading this in a newspaper, because it's syndicated to different newspapers, those are probably the places where the... let me put it this way. Those are probably the cities where this was published. Maybe. I'm not sure, you know, but it's that kind of thing that when... if you were reading this at the time, you'd have been in one of those cities if you were reading this when it was being serialized in a newspaper. And then there's also a list of countries about and how much they donate. And this is good fun because he comments on the characters and the little bit of a history, like recent history and recent news of those countries. Like he said, oh, in Spain, they donated this much. And France, they, you know, they thought, well, this is a bit silly. You know, you're Americans, you know, you crazy Americans going for this. But they donate a lot anyway. And England doesn't donate anything. And Switzerland only donates a little bit because, you know, they think it's going to be a waste of time and it's too dangerous and it's not going to be worth it and stuff like that. And that's actually, you know, really good fun way of looking at these other, like the characters or the perceived characters of the different countries, the different stereotypes wrapped up in how much money they're going to give to such a big project and their attitude to America and things like that. Which actually, I made a comment here, it's so much better than Last and First Men, because in Last and First Men, it's like this future history of the world, and it's talking so much about the character of this nation, and they fight each other because of the character. But it's always just like, now, here is the character of the Russian person, and here is the character of the Indian person, and here is the character of the British person, and here is the character of America. But it just explains it in a really dry way. It just tells you. Whereas, you know, it's that whole show don't tell in you know, when you're writing and when you're doing all this kind of, you know, screenwriting and stuff like that. Actually, use the story to explain the character, and use the story to explain the story. Actually, what's happening in the book to explain what's going on, rather than just, as the narrator does, sits there and explains to you the character of this, or sits there and like explains to you all the exposition of what's happened so far. So, you know, you've got to be careful with that. And Last and First Men, that's probably why it's so dry, because it's just like the narrator's just sitting there explaining stuff to you. But in this book, it's like wrapped up in the story. Of course, there is a lot of explanation and long technical passages, like, okay, this is how they get the carbon dioxide, or the carbonic acid, as they call it in the book. This is how they get out the air, and this is how much oxygen they're going to need. And there's like a whole way of using like different, you know, potassium and mixing it with all this other kind of stuff to make the air breathable and scrub out the carbon dioxide. And that's all interesting. It's strange. And also, there are there's quite a few hints about what happens at the end of the book, but I'm not going to give them now because, you know, you'll pick up on them. Like, let me, for example, the response of Switzerland and you know, why they don't want to donate very much, you know, because it's too dangerous is a good thing. Let's move on. Oh, yeah, the themes now. Here we go. Bit strange way of looking at this, because normally I talk about the theme, you know, what the science fiction is really saying, you know, is it about the politics, or is it about, you know, human identity, or is it about mortality, and all these different kind of themes. But here, in this book, the theme is science fiction, because, like I say, this is some of the earliest science fiction. Beforehand, I guess there was always fantasy, like the what if, you know, what if someone goes to the moon, you know, what will they find there? Aha, here we go, someone does it. But this isn't just what if, you know, that's just fantasy. Some science fiction as well. But really what science fiction is like, what if, and how could we make it work if and that makes it science fiction. And it really explains this in the book. It actually says at the beginning of the book, okay, here's all the other ways that people have proposed getting to the moon, you know, and it's all like someone goes up there with some, you know, with a big balloon, and someone else goes up there by, you know, closing his eyes and jumping in a circle, and fairies take him there. And it actually says, oh, but these are just fiction, they're just flights of fancy. You know, given what we know of the rules of the universe, and given what we know about the moon, and he explains all it knows about the moon. It says, given what we know about how far it is to the moon, and he explains all that. Given what we know about, you know, canon technology, and he explains all that. He says, could it really be possible, and how would it be done? And, like I say, this is science fiction in a way that, you know, that science fiction had never been done before. This was making the story of the science, like the actual, like the science behind the technology, and then them developing the technology is the story. And again, it sounds like, yeah, of course, that's science fiction. But when you actually read it, you're thinking, no, of course, this is so much about the technology, not so much about the characters, and even the story itself isn't there, because the story is the science fiction. The main theme is it interesting to write a story so heavily based on the technology and the science behind the technology and how it would be possible to build it? And of course it works out. Yes, it is very popular, and that's why Jules Verne is one of the most popular authors in the world, and that's why his stories have survived this far. It's sort of like, okay, around the world in 80 days, would it be possible? Yes, and then how would we do it? Well, you need to catch, well, there's new things called balloons and trains and all this kind of stuff, and steamships and things like all this new technology at the time, and it's like, well, it could be possible to do that. You know, others of his books are more sort of fanciful and less sciencey, but yeah, there it is. And I mean, there are some other themes, you know, explored in the book, but like I say, back in 1865, science fiction was something new, and the actual experiment of science fiction itself probably wasn't even called that back then, but that is like the main idea in the book. So overall, easily a 4-star book because it's short and it's fun. It is quite funny. You know, the translation that I read here, I don't know if there's like one standard translation that everyone reads, but it does read like an old, you know, it is, the writing is very dated, but you know, it's like such a historical perspective on science. You're actually reading the character of people back in 1865. So just in that way, you know, as a historical kind of document, it's actually really good fun. And it's really easy read. You know, you read it in just a few hours and the ending is great. So, you know, like, what more do you want? And of course, yeah, I do want a bit more, you know, a bit more story, a bit more story complexity would have been great, and, you know, a bit more character development. But you, as I said, it's not about that. And sometimes with such a short book, you can't have too many subplots going on. You just need it to be going on. And of course, it's free as well. You can go to, I got it on the iPod, I guess, through the freebooks.com or bookfeeds.com or something like that, which you access through the Stanza store on the iPod Touch or on the iPhone. But you can just go to Project Gutenberg and download it there. So it is worth reading. You know, it is very accessible. Don't think, no, oh, it's really old. Just give it a go. It is worth it. So I'm going to give it 4 stars. And the next book that I'm going to read is a more classic science fiction, not quite so old. I'm going to read Ray Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451, which must be over 50 years old. So, and I'll explain the reasons why I'm reading that next time in the next episode. I've just started it, and it's having a lot of fun with that. So, I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you're interested in more of what I do, just keep subscribed. Yeah, this might be your first ever episode that you listen to. I hope you enjoyed it. So, yeah, but you can also follow me on Twitter. Lots of short updates there about what I do. Yeah, and often if I post a new blog post, I mention it on Twitter too. But otherwise, yes, at Luke Burridge at Twitter, or twitter.com/LukeBurridge, or go to LukeBurridge.com and click on the blog and other stuff like that. And you can actually click on and read my own novel there as well. I've got some new cover art for my novel, so I'm very proud of that. A guy called Stefan Kernvac, I think, I can't remember his name now. Anyway, so Stefan, he made some fantastic cover art for it. So I mean, yeah, just some cover art. Just check it out. Looks good fun. And also, finally, yes, go to goodreads.com/Luke Burridge if you want to suggest some books to me, or check what other books have been suggested to me, or if you want to see what I'm going to be reading next, or what I have on my shelf at home to read and things like that. That's the best way to catch up. Or just email me with any feedback, with any book suggestions, with anything at all that you want from me, any questions you've got at all, just email me. Someone asked me, hey, are you thinking of doing a fantasy novel book review or fantasy book review podcast, or do you know anyone who does do that? And I'm like, well, no, it's not really the kind of thing I'm into. Maybe I'll actually just post that email up on my blog, because, you know, it'll make a good blog post. And other people asking, hey, what do you think about the later Dune book? So maybe actually what I'll do is start replying to the feedback that I get or the questions that I get by email, but then actually posting the reply, or, you know, writing up the reply as a blog post as well, as just some little thoughts about science fiction or about podcasting or about anything that people want to know about. So email me, luke@juggler.net. Otherwise, thanks for listening, and I'll catch you next time.